This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
Since my career took off, since the Time cover, I have had a major platform where I was able to give back to the community with starting my own youth program and teaching inner city kids photography and things like that. But I think it's very important to give my fellow peers and activists who I have marched with, worked with, cried with, and did everything else with, you know, a platform so you can hear their voice. So now you get to hear, you know, Tawanda, you know, and her amazing story, how she has, you know, dealt with the death of her brother firsthand. You get to hear Malika Reed, one of the most powerful, influential women in Baltimore City if it comes to doing makeup or being on the front lines. You're also going to get to hear Shorty. We call him Shorty. He's a short, militant midget, but he's very, very, he's like a big influence on my activism. He always pushing me to the next level. We have JC. JC is amazing. He has a unique type of activism that is birthed, you know, through him. I don't think anyone does it as good as he does. He has a organization called Circle of Voices, where he'll take an older white Jewish lady and connect her with a guy from the inner city with a mouth full of goals, and they will sit and have a conversation about their lives and find out that they have so much in common and become the best of friends. Then you have Michael Wood, who, you know, he once was on the opposite side of the fence. He probably would have locked me up if he ran into me back in the day. But me and him both seen tragic times. We both were born through the uprising. He spent like 11 years on the wrong side of the fence. He was an enemy, and now he's, you know, more like a brother. You know, he's light-skinned. That's my light-skinned brother. But he does a lot of work. He does amazing work. He speaks out. I invite him always to speak. Did I miss anybody? I said Malika, I said anybody. Well, that's the team that I brought today. Then I have amazing artist by the name of Al Rogers. He's one of my favorite artists from Baltimore. His music is, you know, very peaceful and calming and soothing. So this night is going to make you feel very uncomfortable, but that's the goal. I want you to see what I would face, you know, in my own community. So now we have coming up is JC Folk and Michael Wood. You're going to hear a testimony kind of from this police officer, but I want you to understand what you're about to see are reenactments, things that happen in my community every day, things we hear every day. But, you know, don't go away hating Michael Wood. You know, when they first did this exercise, I kind of gave him like a left eye. Like, do I really like you? Are you really my brother? But, you know, he's a good guy. He's amazing. He's on the right side. He is very inspiring. So I want to bring them to the stage now, and I'm going to turn it over to them.
I want to, like, introduce Mike to you for a second for me. So Mike and I, we've known each other a few months, and when I first met Mike, I didn't know what the hell to do with him. You know, like, there's not one cop that I can say is a good cop that I've ever met. They may do good things sometimes, but I don't know a cop that I would actually say is a good cop. And there's some reasons why I don't think of them as good cops, and that's because if we were citizens, we're standing next to each other, and I see him harm someone, and I do nothing, I would not consider myself a good human being or a good person. Why would I consider a cop that does the same thing? They got people walking around them all the time harming people, and then they don't do anything to correct the problem, then I'm going to call them a good cop? Why would I do that? So I don't do that. So for us, it took a little while, you know, to work through some of that stuff. Like right now, I consider Mike an ally. I consider Mike an ally stronger than some of the people that stand on the front line with us in Baltimore calling themselves frontliners, when in fact they are not fully in the game. I consider him now like a brother to me. And so what you're getting ready to see is it will show you what people go through. Most people think a stop and frisk is something like, you know, you kind of go, you know, like that, and, you know, you're like, you know, lovey-dovey, and then you go away. A stop and frisk is so much more violent than that. We won't even show you the worst that it gets, because if what happens in a stop and frisk when it gets as bad as it gets is Freddie Gray. That's what happens, and, you know, so we'll stop way short of that, but, like, we want you to see a little bit of it so you can understand that they're children. And mothers and grandmothers and fathers going through stop and frisk right now as we speak in this country. So wanted to, you got anything you want to put out there, Mike, before we get up?
Yeah. Just have Devin talk to you.
Yeah, okay.
You guys just stand.
You're good. You good? Okay.
We're good.
So So you can, he wants you to kind of come and hang out. So we want you to, we want to be having a conversation, like two brothers standing on the corner, you know, and then his ass shows up and disrupts shit. So we're going to try to make this as realistic as possible for you so you can see what people go through. Okay. So
what's up?
Hey, yo, gentlemen, I need to see hands. Yo, beat. Turn around. Look away from me. And lace your hands behind your fingers. You got anything I need to know about? Behind your stance. You got anything I need to know about, brother?
No. Huh? No.
You got anything in your pockets that's going to pick me, prod me, prod me?
No.
You sure?
Yeah.
Lean back, man. Why are
you
stance?
What you stopping me
why
for?
Why are you stance?
Why are you stopping me, though?
You got everything on you I need to know about? I got a call for a person
why
with a gun. You got a gun?
Though, why are you
I got a call for a person with a gun. You meet the description, brother.
And huh? What's that? Being black?
So you turn around and look at me.
What you stopping
right?
me for?
Keep your hands right where they are. All right? Where are you from? You got anything I need to know about? You got ID?
Yeah, I got one.
Where are you from?
I'm from here.
No, where the fuck is from here?
Right around the corner.
Where's around the corner?
Why are you stance? Why are you stopping me?
Why are you stance?
Why are you stopping me?
Why are you stance?
Why are you stopping me?
Do we have a problem? Do we have a problem? This is my neighborhood. You see that sidewalk? It doesn't have your name on it, does it? Where are you from?
You have my ID, man.
Where are you coming from? We can play games all day long.
I'm coming from work.
Where's work? Give me a fucking address, man.
You got my ID, man.
You got no drugs on you? You sure?
Yep.
Where are you going?
I'm going home.
Where's home?
It's around the corner.
Man, you need to give me some fucking answers.
You got my ID in your hand, man.
Where is home?
You got my ID in your hand, man.
Where is home?
You got my ID in your hand.
This is how people get themselves locked up, brother. Do you understand that? Then where are you going?
I'm just going home, man.
Home. Where is home? I don't understand why it's a fucking hard question.
It's right there on my ID.
How do I know it's your ID? Where is home? Where's home?
It's on my ID.
I don't have your ID. Where's home?
It's on my ID.
I want to know why it is that everybody wants to say that it's the white man's fault. Yet here you are. You don't listen. We may take you out of the ghetto, but I guess you can't take the nigga out of the ghetto, can you? Where are you going?
Going home, man.
All right. Home, huh? Oh, give me your fingers. Now we're going to go home. You got it? That's jail.
So this ain't as bad as it gets. We wanted to just give you a little peek at what it feels like, what it looks like. I've had moments where I've ended up on the ground, face down, with dogs around me, with cops, 10 cops standing around me with guns pointed at me, and I got handcuffs on behind me.
And where you would have ended
up. I was just on the way home.
That's where you were going.
Just on the way home. So for people who don't know what a stop and frisk looks like, that's like a little bit of what a stop and frisk looks like. Does that, like... Thank you. My address is on the card, man. So is there anyone that like kind of opened up something new for you? Did it open up something new, or are you aware of what a stop and frisk looks like, most of you? Okay, so for me, when I do that, every time that I do it, we were talking about it on the way up here, every time that I do it, it just kind of brings up all of this stuff for me. You know, like I went through it. Yeah, like I've gone through it in my life, and every time I do it, it brings up that I have gone through that many times in my life, and other people are going through this many times in their lives, and every one of you who are privileged enough to have never gone through that, I'm going to ask you to actually fight on behalf of people who do go through that every day. And I'm going to break this down around a racial component, you know, because more black people and people of color go through this than white people do. And what I'm going to ask the white people in the room to do is to fight for us as well. This is not just our fight.
That's right.
This is your fight. As a matter of fact, it's your problem because this stuff is put in place to give white people privilege in this country. And so I'm going to ask you all to do something about that. We go through this. And I'm going to ask everybody in here who's black also who's never gone through this to do get into the same fight. Get into the same fight. Like this thing with us, there's Devin. Tawanda's over here. Tawanda Jones. There's Mike. And we're in this thing. There's Shorty back. Where's Shorty? Shorty back there. The little midget back him. In the corner. Shorty. And I'm going to tell you, there are people on the ground right now fighting for your lives every day. Fighting for your lives every day. Every day. And we need more people to be in the middle of this. This place is not going to change unless we get more of you involved in what's going on out here. Yes.
What is the rationale, what you or anybody else, be a black cop or a white cop or whoever the cop is, what is the rationale that you go to this guy or whoever it is and do that kind of thing that you did? There must be some logic to why you would do this. If he's totally walking on the street with not another person around or not a single contributory situation that would raise a suspicion in you as a police officer that you have to go and search him like you did, for example, what does your commanding officer or previous commanding officer say to you or the others that gives you a rationale that you would ever even think about doing that to him? What is the logic behind it? There has to be some logic behind it. Now, obviously, this film is not necessarily a documentary. It's a one-sided documentary. But what is your side as a former policeman and all the other policemen? Why does somebody say that you have to do that to this guy?
Yeah, everything is about stats. So that's how an officer is judged. So they're judged by how many arrests they get. So everything becomes a fixing expedition. So you are, whatever reason you have, so that would be a call for an armed person that somebody could give out, or drugs on the corner, or it could be just an excuse from, you know, every suspect for a robbery that happened two blocks away is a black male that's about approximately 6 foot tall, dark complexion, white t-shirt, blue jeans. So that's going to be everybody. And then so it just becomes a fixing expedition. I have an excuse to stop him and to see and to check him. And if he has something else on him, which he's more likely to, so if white people and black people carry drugs at the same rate, I come and check him every day, well, then he's going to get a record, whereas I, growing up, would never get a record. So then we look at him more, and now he's a repeat offender. So now I look at him more, and we keep coming after him into that same corner. For example, he would be like a problem person on the corner that's never actually done anything other than fall into that cycle. The other reason is the culture is that you have to control the neighborhood. You have to be the big dog. There's one gang, and that's the gang. It's blue. So especially with him being bigger than me, or if he had a good reputation in the neighborhood, then he would be easily one that I would target in order to disrespect so that people knew who I was, that I was in charge.
Yeah, so if he comes and he does that with me, and let's say I have a position of standing in the community where people respect me, and he comes in and dominates me, then it lets everybody else in the neighborhood think that they should be afraid of them because they can do that with me. I've been out where they used to have, I don't know if they do this in Philly, but they had these jump out squads where you can be standing on the corner and all of a sudden five cars show up and 15 cops will pop out. And then they'll start frisking everybody around. They'll stop and frisk and throwing people on cars and throwing them down on the ground. And they're stopping frisking people all around. And you could be standing with your girlfriend. You know, you're walking and you think everything is cool. And then all of a sudden they pop around and they embarrass you in front of your girlfriend, embarrass you in front of your mother, embarrass you in front of everyone that lives in your neighborhood for nothing. For nothing other than to make you afraid and to make the people around you afraid. And it affects mostly low-income communities of black people that this affects. And it's interesting, I say mostly, but I have a master's degree, folks, and I'm still sometimes laying flat down on the ground with my face on the pavement. It doesn't matter how many degrees I have. And they say, you know, why don't you dress the part, the baggy pants, take the grill out, and go out and live your life like that, then you'll be okay. With your tie on, you're not okay. You're not okay. And so it's all about continuing the fear and oppression of black people in this country. And what the police wind up being is the first line of that. And all the, and really on some level, the police are grunts in that system, because the systemic structure that is America, that is screwed up America is continuing to subjugate black people as if they want slavery to come back. And on some levels, we are, what's happening in this country right now, the level of imprisoned people in this country who look like us, it's insane that this country still gets to do what it does to people, that we haven't had serious uprisings outside of Baltimore, outside of Ferguson, outside of other places, that people haven't stood up in response to what the system does to black people. Baffles me. It baffles me. So it's about fear more than it is about anything else. And the people who wind up being afraid are people who look like me. Any other questions back there?
Thank you for the great presentation. I had a follow-up question. You mentioned that you have these metrics and statistics that makes you have to do this to fulfill your department's requirements. So I was basically, my question was that since you served in the police for like 11 years, if I'm correct, have you seen this change over the years? Is it becoming more and more driven by these numbers and statistics? And is there any particular financial aspect to it as to the department's, the money that they get depends on fulfilling these number of arrests for the whole department and so on, now associated with the prison system, like you mentioned about it being, and so like prisons being especially geared towards like have occupancy rates being a big factor that, oh, we need to have so many people in the prisons, and that's how people make money who are in the prison business. So is that in some way related to how the metrics work for you too?
Well, right now, so you know, when it comes to the metrics and performance measures, there isn't a department in this country that's running any performance measures that are incentivized towards justice. That's actually my PhD work that I'm doing right now, is to get those metrics through the literature. So they're not anywhere. Every department promotes and encourages their officers based upon how many citations they write, how many arrests they make. And I don't know if there's like some mass conspiracy. It could just be a result of not thinking and not applying basic principles of humanity to the profession. But when you come to finances, you have individual finances, which means if I get off at 11 and I need some overtime, and JC might be in 11:45 arrest that I can get 3 or 4 hours of overtime for, and then you don't see the aftermath of that, which has probably been the hardest thing for me since getting into the movement, is you're sheltered from the aftermath of your actions when you're a pawn in that system, and now I'm constantly exposed to the aftermath, and I think that's critical. You have other finances on the big part, like civil asset forfeiture. And those laws are going to be different wherever you are. In Baltimore, that money goes straight to the mayor's coffer. So how can you expect or ever imagine that a mayor would stop something if their finances and their ability to carry out their pet projects depend upon that sort of income? And then you have the private industrial complex. But again, in Maryland, that's not an issue there. So while you see that evil of the prison industrial complex and you have privatized prisons on the other side, in Maryland, it doesn't seem to be that much of a factor that they're going to try and fill those cells, whether they are, you know, fiscal year government balances or private balances.
Do any of these incidents have another side? Why these policemen are even possibly vindicated in any respect whatsoever, but except for the Staten Island?
Yeah, so here's the thing. That's all the other cases. So here's the thing. What I'm going to ask you to do is stop looking for more data to substantiate my pain. Like, I'm in pain. I just like you to hear it. I would just like you to stop for a second and stop trying to justify that you don't have enough data to get, hold on, to get that black people are in pain. We keep saying it. Why can't white people hear us when we're continuing to say it? When we live in a culture that, you know, we were hung in this country, that we went through American enslavement and people were mutilated in this country, and that we continue to be mutilated. There's been tons of stories. It's that you're not paying attention to them. There's a guy, James Craig Anderson. How many of you know that name, James Craig Anderson? James Craig Anderson in 2011 in Mississippi. He was going home from work one night, 2 o'clock in the morning, and some white kids in two trucks, 7 of them in two trucks, left their home saying, "We want to go and fuck up a nigger." They left their home and they rode to a convenience store where he was just going home. They found him in a parking lot and they beat the shit out of James Craig Anderson and left him laying in the parking lot. Left him laying in the parking lot. And then he got up to walk away. He walked a few feet. He was like staggering. And one of the trucks came back and ran him over. It was on a video. It was at the store. The truck literally hit his body and boom, 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 like it was running over top of rocks or a curb or something. And those kids, the guy who was driving the truck, they sent him home, house arrest.
And nobody called him a thug.
Exactly, house arrest. And these things happen all the time in this system. They happen all of the time. And that nothing gets done about it. And it's like, do you know racism exists? Okay, and racism is not this innocuous thing like racism, you know, like, wow, the sun is shining today. Racism exists to kill people, to subjugate people, to have black people do white people's bidding. Let's stop pretending that we don't know what racism is. Racism is killing babies, Tamir Rice, Tyrone West, James Craig Anderson. It's killing people. Sandra Bland, and we're acting like we don't know. Let's stop pretending. Let's stop acting like we need to see something else. We don't need to see anything else. See what's already in front of your eyes and then ally with us or get in it like you're a human being with us. We're dying because of a structure that's set up to benefit you. Get in it with us and stop looking for something else. Look for what's already there and then get up out of your seat and get in it and stop your people from killing us.
Wow. This is the type of conversation I was hoping for all day. I hope, you know, despite what you have to say, I'm going to give you the mic, say your piece. Don't sit here and be silent, scared to ask questions because you want to offend us. You're offending us by not asking those questions. So feel free to ask anything that you want to ask. Engage us. That's why we're here. You need answers, we're here to give them to you.
Yeah. Wait for the mic. Let it come back to you.
Run around, Devin. Run around. He's got to record it, brother.
Test 1, 2, 3. Can you hear me okay?
Mic check.
Hey, I just had a question. I'm a foreigner. I grew up thinking like all police are the best people ever, everywhere, until I've lived in Philly and D.C. And you, sir, on this side, I can understand. But yeah, sorry. I'm so sorry. I don't know your name. That story makes a lot of sense to me in a way that 15 years ago, I'd be like, wow, that's just a crazy case. What I want to do is ask you, sir, if I understand you're a former law enforcement, I just want to know, what are you doing? What is your relationship to law enforcement today? People who might not be, if you don't mind me being very brash here, kind of discuss this gentleman's story and say, oh, it's just a bunch of crazy circumstances. Because what you're speaking about speaks to the culture of law enforcement, and I think is sort of like the first step for some people, if that makes sense. And I hope I'm not hurting anybody's feelings by saying that. Because I feel like a lot of people are just going to be skeptical because they just do not live a lot of the things that we're talking about here.
Totally get it. It's a totally common question that we get all the time. So I think policing is like a microcosm of society itself. And so now we know we have about 35% of a certain side of the political party, which is obviously racist and expressing that hate at the moment. I think you have the same thing in the police department where you kind of have that, maybe those old baby boomers that still have that in them and they're lashing out. But I have hundreds, if not thousands, of emails from officers around the country, people that are thinking about going in, and they get it. It's like, it's just going to be really slow, and we have to keep talking to them about it. It's that they're pawns in a system, and they don't understand it. Usually once we get them to understand, then that switch starts to go on, and they start to approach it a little differently, even though the system's guiding them. And we still have to get that system to allow them to express that side, and now the system is holding that down.
We're going to hold off on your questions. I want to thank Michael Wood and JC for that. It takes a lot to reenact, you know, a pat down. I done been through them all my life. You know, when I get stopped now, it's just so regular to me. You know, I don't even get mad no more. I'm like, all right, it is what it is. But now I'm going to bring my sister up. This is Tawana Jones, who lost her brother Tyrone West due to police brutality. I wanted you just to see a glimpse into the world of how police think and how they do before I brought her up. So I want to bring my sister Tawana Jones up. This is an amazing, magnificent woman. Since she lost her brother, it's been 2 years?
Almost 3 years.
And she protests every single Wednesday. She has a full-time job, but she protests every single Wednesday. Rain, sleet, snow, hail, acid rain, whatever. She's out there on the forefront. She's very inspiring. She keeps a lot of us going when we don't want to get up out of bed and fight this battle. So I'm going to let you, you know, so she could tell you her story. I can't tell it. So here's Tawana Jones.
First of all, I want to thank Devin. Thank you so much just for having us here today. The saddest part is I'm happy to be here, but I'm so sad under these circumstances because I wouldn't wish this type of pain on anyone. And the saddest part is there's so many clueless people out here that don't really understand what's going on right in front of their eyes. And the first thing that they do is dehumanize the victims, blame them for their brutal death, their brutal murders, their executions, and they get away with it. And it's sad because we live in a capitalist system that it pays to kill. It pays to assassinate our black and brown bodies and poor people, period. And then the crazy part is people don't understand. The first thing they do is blame the victims. My brother Tyrone West was brutally murdered. He was executed. He was beat to death. So you saw that what happened to Eric Gardner. And let's not get it twisted. Eric Gardner, that's what the media put out that said that he was selling loose cigarettes. No, Eric Gardner wasn't doing nothing. Because the first video that they ever put out when the guy was videoing it, you hear him say, "Oh shucks, here go these officers again." All that man doing was breaking up a fight. Eric Gardner had just broke up a fight. So he was not being arrested for anything. And so when the officer came, and this same officer that came over there and started putting Eric Gardner in the chokehold, when he was like, "Look, you're not going to harass me today." He was known for harassing black men with that stop and frisk foolishness. You know what I'm saying? He was known for that. And he was known for fondling black men. You can look it up. I urge you, look it up. He was known, and they had lawsuits out on the same officer. He was known for fondling black men in New York City. So the whole thing of what I'm trying to say is what the media does is they paint this scene and back the foolishness of the crime scene, and they manipulate things. I'm going to give you a big thing right here. July the 18th, 2013, my brother Tyrone West had just started, that day started off as a beautiful day. My brother had went to work. He bought my vehicle. He dropped me off at work, dropped my kids off. I'm a school teacher. I was one back then, still is to this day. Okay, so he dropped me off, come back to pick me up from work. And it was so beautiful because our schedules worked unique because at the time he would get off of work, he was able to come and pick me up. So the whole thing in a nutshell, we went to go eat dinner after 5:30, went to go eat. He was interrupted. Our dinner was interrupted from a young lady just needing a ride. And so my brother looked at me, and then I would be remiss right here for not even mentioning Trayvon Martin, because we're talking about 3 years of Trayvon Martin what happened to Trayvon Martin, because my brother's dying words was Trayvon Martin, because the verdict had came in that Saturday that George Zimmerman was found not guilty. And it touched me and my brother's heart so bad. And to know that my brother left this world screaming, "Trayvon Martin, help! Why are you doing this to me?" And then for people to read Lord blogs, and then my family had to get harassed for stepping up and stepping forward. And to hear ignorant, "Oh, well, he was a thug. He did this. He had, well, check this out. He was not on any outstanding warrants. They had no reason to pull my vehicle over. And the first two killer cops, Nicholas Davis Chapman and Officer Ruiz, they almost killed the man in the same neighborhood 17 days before. And nothing happened to them. And this man, Abdul, had his baby in the back seat of the car. And these were what you call jump out boys. Unmarked car. They pulled my brother over. He didn't even know he was being pulled over. He stopped. Witnesses, eyewitnesses, credible eyewitnesses said everything that they saw. And the only thing that they based themselves off was what the killer cop said and what the young lady in my vehicle said. And at the end of the day, she saw one unarmed man get beat to death by 11 to 15 Baltimore City police officers. Men, women jumped on one unarmed man, pepper sprayed him, tased, and they let a 300-pound man from Morgan sat on my dying brother's back. And here it is. He's driving my car. They had all my information. No one never called my family. Instantly, 7 o'clock, I swear to God, God forgive me, I felt so much of pain on my left side. I couldn't believe it. It was unreal. I fell out my bed. Could not know what, didn't know what was happening with my body. And then when I got up off the floor, instantly I'm like, oh my God, something's wrong with my brother. My family thought I was freaking out. I'm calling him, he didn't answer. And finally it was confirmed on the 10 o'clock news, my brother dead body on the news with sobbing witnesses said how he was beat worse than Rodney King. My brother's body was hidden from my family for 5 days, even after we saw it on the news. We couldn't even get his body from the funeral home. It took them 154 days to tell us some foolishness to say my brother died of a heart attack and dehydration. And then I have a bunch of idiots jumping on my blog saying, oh, well, he didn't get killed. He died of a heart attack and all this foolishness. My brother was a healthy young man, no heart problem, just had a healthy physical 2 weeks before he was brutally murdered. I have the proof. I went with him because he was changing his job, and they sent him. He had a healthy physical. Nothing was wrong with my brother, but this is the foolishness in which the media perpetuates and plays off, and people not knowing believes this stuff. But the media didn't tell you that, oh, Abdul Salam, my family had to find out how, because we was on the ground from day one. 947 days, 135 weeks. This West Wednesday was the worst one by far. It was raining a bloodstorm. We was out there, and not only just West Wind, we was just in Annapolis trying to change what I call the officer killer rights, which allows them, it's a Maryland law that allows these officers 10 days before they even give a statement. And in my brother's case, they had 154. And we are the reason, the West family and the supporters are the reason why Marlon Mosby is in office as of this day, because we got the outstate attorney, Greg Bernstein, out of office for not doing his job. He got all these killer cops walk the beat. And guess what? My family's walking the beat with them. He gave them full immunity before he even got the statement. To this day, 947 days, no autopsy pictures. How in the hell do you do an autopsy and you have no pictures? Why? Because we know pictures says things, videos. It was video footages of my brother's brutal death. So you saw how Eric Garden, you said that was the most touching one of all, because that was touching. It was heartbreaking. And I cried so bad, and immediately I reached out to Eric Garden's family and went and stood in solidarity in New York City. My family, along with his family. I met Tamir Rice's family. I'm tired of meeting families under these. I wouldn't wish nobody family to this family, because it's one that you will never forget, and it changes your life forever. But at the end of the day, you have to fight for what's right. And we fought peacefully before the uprise. We fought peacefully. We ain't never tear up nothing, but until a CVS got burnt down, that's when they wanted to talk about Freddie Gray, a poor unarmed man. And the saddest part with our mayor, she finally, the first time ever, I seen her go to a nap, even though she was there last year. But the first time ever, she wanted to go in and support the bill we was lobbying for. But it's interesting. You want to go in and talk all this good stuff while you on the way out the door. Something's wrong with that picture. Why couldn't you talk about it then? Instead of her referencing, she kept on using an officer that beat up a guy on a bus stop. She should have referenced Tyrone West, the worst case of police brutality I've ever seen. He was pulled over unarmed, brutally beat to death, pepper sprayed, tortured. And at the end of the day, my family still don't have no answers. But we know that he was brutally murdered. And we know this for certain, and two things for sure. We're never going to stop fighting for him. And while we out there fighting for Tyrone West, we out there fighting for Freddie Gray, Tamir Rice, Sandra Bland, and all the victims of police brutality. We will not stop until killer cops are in cell block, because to me, that is justice. That is justice. Because when you pay the family off, you're paying them back their tax money. It's not about the income. It's about the outcome. That's what it's about. Nobody's family should be brutally murdered. Nobody should fear that. And for fear, you're fearing of the cops and the robbers. Like, I live in the hood. So at the end of the day, I'm afraid of, oh, what robber's going to try to get me or kill me. And I'm afraid of the damn cops. And I'm more afraid of the cops than I am of the robbers. Because the robbers, they a wave or whatever. If I got a tail light out, I'm in fear. I remember one day I got pulled off, never forget, on Thanksgiving. Pulled over. And my kids was in the car, and my 7-year-old daughter was screaming, oh my God, they're going to kill us like they could. And I was just praying. That was like a praying moment for me. I'm like, God, please don't let this be a rude officer. I want this to be a learning moment for my daughter, because I want her to trust. I want, if my child get lost in the mall, she needs to go up to people that's supposed to serve and protect us for them to bring her back to me. That's what it's supposed to be about. Not about we being in fear. She's standing there lost like, oh, my God, who do I go to? They're going to kill me. If I go to them, they killed my uncle. They might kill me. No, that's something wrong with that picture. So at that moment, thank God, it was a good officer. He was very friendly. He even gave my daughter a coloring book. And I'm like, yes, thank God. I was so happy. And I said, see, all cops aren't bad. But I'm tired of saying it. Because if you see something and you don't say nothing, you're just as bad. You're just as bad. That's just like if I'm a teacher now and I see one of my co-teachers brutalizing a child, smacking them around or doing something that is not in our job duty. We're there to educate children and to bring the best out of them at all times. Not to belittle them and things of that nature. So if I see it, I'm telling. I don't care. Call me a snitch. Call me what you want to call me. I'm going to report you. And I'm gonna let them, and I'm gonna let you know I'm gonna report you. So that's how it should be. So I just wanna thank y'all, but I just wanna let y'all know, please, for one second, do your own homework. Don't believe what the media said. And I remember too, and I don't know if I'm being punished by this, but I remember before my brother was brutally murdered, when I heard about Anthony Anderson. And Anthony Anderson was another young, unarmed man who was tossed on his head. And this was way before Freddie Gray. This was a year before my brother was brutally murdered by the same unit. The same unit responsible for his death killed my brother. But when I heard it on the news and they said that Anthony Anderson swallowed drugs and, you know, he died and they pulled up his record, so I'm thinking like, and at the end of the day, if he swallowed drugs and not, my heart just instantly went out. That's a human being. That's a life gone. So instantly I was like, my heart went out, but I was more at ease because I'm like, oh, thank God the officers probably ain't do nothing. I'm like, officers probably ain't do nothing. They got a hard job, whatever. I didn't believe that. You're not going to know it. You're not going to know that there's no justice system that is just us until you need to utilize it. I feel like I've been tricked all my life. I'm a law-abiding citizen. I do my jury duty. I pay taxes, all of that. And for when you need help from these people, they give you a number and turn their back on you. The man turned her back on my family for 6 months. She would not meet with my family. And every occasion we tried to talk to her, she act like she didn't even know about Tyrone West. I never heard about her. I'm going to call you. This is the foolishness that my family endured. And this is why we out here, because nobody family deserves that. Nobody. So at the end of the day, I just ask y'all, please, when y'all hear stuff, please just dig deeper. That's all I ask you, just because at the end of the day, it could be you. It's not about a black body or what. It's about a human life. These people were all human beings. They belong to somebody or loved one. You might not know them. You may not even like them. But they're somebody's loved one. Just keep that in mind. Imagine if it was your loved one. How would you feel? Especially somebody supposed to serve and protect. And they be the ones that brutalize you. It's disgusting. But at the end of the day, and I still feel like there are good men and women in blue out there. But I'm just urging the ones that's out there just to step up and say what they see and stop it. Because if you stand there and you watch somebody get brutalized, you're just as bad. Thank you so much.
I want to thank you again for coming up here. I know every time I hear her story, it's like I heard it for the first time, and it hits home every time. Every time. Because I can be Tyrone West. I can be Freddie Gray. Recently in Baltimore, we had another act of injustice against the police officer broke a young man's arm in two different places, and all he did was ask a question. But he's now facing 7 charges of assault on a police officer. He saw someone, supposedly the story goes, he saw someone that he knew being arrested. He knew one of the officers, so he went to go ask a question. And he asked, why is my friend being arrested? That's what he asked the officer he knew. The white officer grabs him, pins his arm so far up his back, shatters his shoulder, fractures his shoulder, snaps the lower half of his arm. They made him walk to jail. You hear me? Think about it. Shoulder shattered, lower arm, you in pain. You have to walk 3 blocks to jail. Where's the squad car? So he's arrested. He goes to the hospital. So 2 days later, police pop up. He's heavily medicated. They interrogate him. Sorry, couldn't get it out. But they put, because this stuff really gets to me, you know, and it really touched home with me because this young man, I reached out to his brother. He was put in contact with me through social media, you know, because a lot of people reach out to me and say, hey, can you use your platform for this? And I'm open to it. And when I reached out to him, he turned around and said, thank you. But before I tell you what happened, I want to thank you because you invested so much time in my niece over the summer. You know, you worked with her youth camp at your exhibit in Reginald F. Lewis Museum in Baltimore. So I'm like, dang, Baltimore's that small. I work with this man's niece. And I was like, no, I got to fight a little bit harder for this one. So I've been allowing the family to use my Instagram as their outlet to get it out. So basically, after they came and interrogated him, they basically placed him. First, he had no charges. Then all these magical charges just appeared, poof, charges. They came back to the hospital and locked him up. Locked him up, took him to jail. He just got out of surgery. Had to get a metal plate in his arm, and he had to get screws in his lower arm. They took him to jail and refused to give him his pain medication after surgery. And this just happened this past Saturday. You know, so obviously the police have learned anything. You know, that's just what's going on in Baltimore now. Before I came here, I was documenting it, trying to get that story out. And even the media was nowhere to be found until recently, till you had, you know, me put it on Instagram. Then you had other activists get wind of it, you know, for me putting it on Instagram. Like Shorty and his team found out about it. The BMO block found out about it. From there, you had people like Jamal Bryant behind the scenes working and promoting it. You know, but it's not the media didn't come. We forced them to come by applying that pressure of social media. So every one of you sitting in these chairs, when you think about these conversations that you're hearing, these are people on the front line that's affected every single day. This is something that we live every day. If you can get on social media and just post something, you know, find these people on Facebook and send them blessings. That's how you start. It starts with one small act a day. They accumulate. So, like, I'm going to take a line from JC, you know, like, he'll say when the uprising started, because it's like you get this adrenaline rush, it becomes addictive, but you feel like you have to do more. So, you know, you put your big toe in the water, it's kind of cold, so you take it out. That's the first step. Then you put your whole foot in, then you just jump on in. So just start with something small. If you're walking down the street and you see a brother, you know, I'm a brother. When you know, I got braids in my hair, I wear the bush. Sometimes I walk in certain neighborhoods, and people do clench their purses. Not so much because everyone in the city just about knows me, but they clench their purses. You know, instead of that, next time you see a brother, no matter how scared you might be, say hello. How are you doing? Have a nice day. And that's how you start it. You start with that small step, and then you can do more. You know, but that's what's going on in Baltimore. I just encourage everyone, you know, take these stories to heart from these people. You know, implement those things in your everyday life. It starts small.
I'm going to be real quick, because while he was talking about things that's going on in Baltimore, so it's this guy named Keith Davis Jr. He got shot 40-something times, and now he's still in prison, and he just went to court, and they basically dropped all the charges. He basically was exonerated, but he's left with, because they put so many charges on you, he's left with a handgun charge. Well, how can you be found not guilty for everything else? Because he was at the wrong place at the wrong time. So I want you to find out about these stories and give your support. Thank you.
The guy he's talking about, his name is Aaron Winston. If you look him up online, you'll see. Like this, I just pulled his picture up. This happened a couple of days ago, right?
Saturday.
Like a couple of days
ago. At the power plant.
So even though Freddie Gray happened, even though it happened, even though we've gotten international attention, the police in Baltimore, they still continue to brutalize people. And I would bet you that the police in Philadelphia are still continuing to brutalize people. After all of that, after all of this work that we do, we still deal with the same thing. It's appalling.
Yeah. So the next activist I'm calling up is Shorty. He's amazing. You know, he's amazing. Like, he don't give a damn. You know, like, he puts toilets in front of City Hall. I swear he go to jail a little bit too much. He's been fighting forever. He's been around since the 90s. You started in the 90s, right? Yeah, when I was a baby, I was just learning how to walk when he was out from Chicago to Baltimore, you know, really laying down work. He's very supportive of my work. He's like my activist father. You know, he tells me what moves to make. He always giving me advice. So I'm going to let you hear from him. You know, he has some, you know, a lot of activists, and I'm not even going to call them activists. We got a lot of Uncle Toms who pose as activists, and they're not really activists because they won't risk their career or you really put that time in. You know, and Shorty's one of them people who puts that time in, doesn't care about what he loses. He puts it all on the line, and he's very, very, very physical and verbal. And because of that, some of these Uncle Toms won't give him a platform, you know, to speak at things like this, but he don't need no platform. So I encourage you to find his Facebook, find him on Twitter. I will be tweeting and posting pictures on my Instagram because he needs to be heard. Shorty.
My activism started in 1986. March the 3rd, 1986 is when I started my activism. This war on drugs is what y'all experiencing now, the results of the war on drugs, all right? 1986, I turned in guns and drugs to the police at the police station. I was a drug dealer. I didn't want to sell drugs no more. I had kids. I wanted my kids to grow up and live, all right? So to change the problem, I didn't have to be a part of that product. I'm a 50s baby. I was born in 1959. How many people is old in here? All right? So this is going to refresh your memory. In 1959, Emmett Till was murdered for looking at a white woman. And Emmett Till wasn't looking at a white woman. He was stuttering, and he whistled. And his whistle got him killed because he couldn't talk well. All right? I'm bringing up Emmett Till for the fact that I'm going to tie up history to the present. Black lives don't matter. It didn't matter then, and they don't matter now. You've been killing black people in America since you brought black people to America. We just changed lynches to choke holes and bullet holes. You understand what I'm telling you? This ain't new to me. It's new to you. This ain't my fight, but this is still our struggle. And if we're going to make a change, we need to use the people in this room. How many people in this room go to school? Damn, look at all them hands. What's your age demographics? I'm going to tell you something. I got 9 kids. I got from 37 to 26. You feel me? And I've been doing my activism, but I don't involve my family in it. You feel me? Because they would do something to your family. I'm saying this. We lost this generation from the 70s, the 80s, and the 90s because y'all got caught up in this cosmetic world of drugs, sex, and all this other things. You got preoccupied. You know what I'm saying? Everybody wanted to be a rapper. Everybody wanted to be Michael Jordan, but didn't nobody want to take care of the communities that they lived in. Everybody wanted to be Scarface, sell drugs. You feel me? This, what you're seeing and experiencing now, is the results of that selling drugs. You put a militarization in our communities. In Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore. And the only thing in Baltimore, we had an uprising. But that was just a match that lit a fuse. If they wouldn't have lit up CVS, you wouldn't have them police under arrest. They'd have been free because all you killed was another nigga, another man that looked like me. If they killed Emmett Till, and I'm quite sure you know this, how many black men have they killed since you've been on this earth? Quite a few, right? So what's the difference in then and now? Ain't nothing changed, man. You can find me on Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter. Don't get no sweeter because we got to use social media to beat the media that they got in place. They use mainstream media against us. When you was growing up, and those 50 people was growing up, didn't they demonize black people, made you scared of a black man, lock your doors when you seen them? They do the same thing now. Don't they do it in the Inner Harbor? Don't they do it down in Philadelphia? Tourism and black people don't mix. You feel me? Because we affect your money. Let's make common sense. I'm an activist, and I act out. I don't care where we at, I shut it down. I shut it down. I go on City Hall, I go to your house, your job, wherever it takes to get your attention, I'll come there. But I just don't do it in an active way in protesting. You got to beat these people and you got to beat this situation in the courts. You got to put that paperwork on them like Thurgood Marshall did. You understand what I'm telling you? Because Martin Luther King didn't get the things that he got just because he marched and said we shall overcome. He had the public 64 Public Rights Accommodation Act. He had the Voting Acts. We haven't had any legislation to protect our people since then. So it's your job and your job and your job to do that. We got to start registering to vote and making our votes count. I'm a black Republican. Do I look like Donald Trump? These educated people in this room didn't in 1867, wasn't the Senate and the Congress full of black people? Now why ain't no black people in there now? Because if you're going to change the laws, you got to change the complexity of the courts and the people that's writing them laws. The Constitution was written for white people. Ain't no black people put their hand on that pen. You feel me? But them laws supposed to be abiding to all of us. So if they abide to all of us, then we got to start using them. Take it to the street. Protest where you affect their money. Go to the Inner Harbor. Go to places where you make them uncomfortable. Shut them down, man. Martin Luther King used to shut them down, didn't he? You feel me? Nonviolent peaceful demonstration. Do it in a nonviolent peaceful way, but do it where it hurts them the most. Do it where they money. The prison industry ain't nothing but legalized slavery. We talk about the police. I'm going to ask these educated people again. Where did the police come from? I'm not asking y'all. Y'all are slaves. Where did it come from? It came. Police was conceived because of slave catching. That's what their job was. That's what they was conceived of. They was to protect white people. You feel me? So if you don't realize that it's still done, it just repackaged it in another generation. Because they don't teach you that in school. They'll teach you about Thomas Jefferson, but they don't teach you about his kids. You feel me? So all I'm doing tonight, I want y'all to wake up. Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
That's what you do when you hear that sound off. Because then that's uniting you. You listening. You paying attention. Other than that, y'all just been sitting there bobbing your heads. They got bobble heads in the store. You feel me? We need participation. We need you to pay attention. And need you when you pay attention, to put your attention to action. All right? Y'all can start your own groups. Anybody can be an activist. But what you choose to be an activist for. How many of y'all Christian believe in God? You can be atheist or whatever. You believe in the good of the community, correct? So in the good of the community, do what's good in your hood. Do what needs to be done.
You know, like, I pick these people to come and speak because they all have important but different views on the situation. Some are political. Some are more spiritual. Some are more militant in their outreach. Some are more verbal. Some are physical. But one thing that we have is love. Love for our people and love for our community, so we stand together. Even though we might disagree, you know, I remember JC, I saw JC one day, and him and Michael Wood sat on the phone fussing for an hour. But you know what they did? They got to the event, and they worked together as one. Our views are different, but we are fighting this same battle. This is war. This is war. You know, it's nothing. It's clear cut. This is war. It's about what position are you in this war? Are you one of the people that's fleeing the town? Are you leaving? Are you on the ground, on the front lines, like it's D-Day? Are you in IT? Are you on the computer sending the bombs to hit? Are you the nurse? Do you come in and save? Or are you in the Air Force? That's what I'm saying. You have to pick your position. Everyone is not built to be on the front lines. You're not built to protest, and that's fine. Some people are better on social media.
Y'all historians, think about the underground. What did the underground do with Harriet Tubman? What did the underground do during the Revolutionary War? So play your positions. Use your skills to best serve the community.
Exactly. See, me, I like being on the front lines. I love documenting. I love being in the middle. I like the danger. I get the adrenaline rush from it. Some people not for that. And I don't want you on the front lines if you're not really down with the get down, because you have to watch my back as I take pictures. But I got brothers who sit on that Twitter and that Facebook that get my images around. Retweets from Shorty. Reposts from my sister Malika, who has 20,000 friends on Facebook before the uprising. Been doing her thing, going around speaking. She's been on Bill Cunningham, Bethany. She got a top-selling book that talks about her story and how she evolved and became this magnificent woman that she is. This is my big sister. We was friends way before the uprising. She was actually one of the first people to pay me for a photo shoot. When she offered to pay me, I was like, shit, okay. My first money. You know, but we support each other. You know, her, Tay, you know, we are family. You know, come be a part of this family. We welcome you with open arms. We need you. We need each other for this change. The change starts with you. But now I'm going to get on up. This sister is like my big sister. Me and her, we are very, very spiritual, awake. You know, we meditate. You know, we into these things. You know, she inspires me. You know, she keeps me grounded. You know, sometimes I feel like giving up. She drops some knowledge on me and it keeps me going. You know, Tay, another one, so awake, so powerful. She did so much during the uprising. Not only did she march, she brought together our mayors. Sheila Dixon, who's running, who stole money, stole gift cards for the community, and was kicked out, had to step down. She's running again now. But she came to Malika's march, and she brung Mayor Stephen, what's her name? Rawlins Blake, our current mayor. That she brought both those mayors together. They was being childish. They didn't want to take a picture. We had to force them to take a picture, but they still had to have a person in between them. And those are the political people that are running Baltimore right now. That childish not to put their differences aside. And those are the people that's trying to control and pass the laws that we need. Psh, they children, and that's what they are. But come on up, Malika. You know, I had to bring her last because she goes in. She's going to talk about activism, empowerment of women, spirituality, everything. So do your thing.
Hey, everyone. I'm so happy to be here. So proud of my little brother for bringing us here. This is just such a phenomenal movement, exhibit, and everything for us to just come together and understand what's actually happening in our community. My name is Malika Reed L., and I'm an entrepreneur. A very successful one. I say very successful because I'm successful because my people support my business. I'm also the author of a top-selling book. I'm ready for my close-up. And it's a top seller because my people support my business and support my book. And I'm an activist. Really, the word activist, the root word is active. I've been active in my community for a very long time. Giving back to my community, educating the women, educating the little girls, teaching them how to sit, how to stand, how to be ladies, what not to do, when to do, and where to do it. I've been speaking at all the Baltimore City Public Schools, from high schools to middle schools, way before the uprising, making sure hundreds of girls go to prom, and we take care of their dresses and their nails and their hair and everything. One of the things I want to talk about is the woman. A professor in the crowd, he asked me, and I'm the young lady with the afro holding the sign, the rise of the woman equals the rise of the nation. That's me. And the picture on this side of the wall where you see all the women, everybody in the crowd, that was the 365 Empress March. I am the founder of the 365 Empress Movement, a movement of women that come together to raise the frequency and the energy in our community just by being the woman. The professor in the crowd asked me, he said, what exactly does that mean? So now I'm going to break it down to you so you can understand what the rise of the woman equals the rise of the nation actually mean. In order for the man to even rise, in order for the nation to even rise, the woman has to first wake up and take her rightful place in society and understand her power as woman. The first school of life happens in the womb, man, right? So every single thing that we eat, we drink, we listen to, we watch, I'm going to say it again, listen to, that vibration goes into that baby. So before you are our son and before you are our husband, you are our child. So then we give you life. We bring you here. You can't even exist without coming through the woman first. So it is very important as women for us to understand who we truly are. The power that we truly hold. So one of the things that the 365 Empress Movement does is we make real knowledge deposits. No, we weren't just brought over here on boats. That's part of it. We were here. We're the people that let our people know that we were here because we are the Aboriginal indigenous people of this land. We let our people know, and we understand that we let our women know that we are mother of all civilization. All civilization. And in order for the foolishness with these police to stop, we have to understand and teach our people real law. Universal law manifested in the flesh. God body. That's us. That's us. That's who we are. We are the people that educate our people about everything that we are made of and how powerful our melanin is. All of us are not against the dark-skinned brother. We understand how powerful the melanin is and how they're even trying to clone it because it holds that much power and they turned us against it. Somebody asked me where was my afro. Sometimes I wear my afro and sometimes I flat on my hair. I do what I want to do. But I wear my afro because I want my women and I want my people to understand that we understand the power of our hair, and that it's our spiritual antennas that connects us to the universe. That's how powerful our hair is. Our hair is like that because of our melanin. It's lamb's wool. Aboriginal, indigenous of this land. I get pulled over by the police all the time, but when I got pulled over on my way up here, true story, I can't make this up. I don't know if it was because I was in my drop-top BMW. I'm not bragging. I'm just saying. We're successful, too. Right? But when he came over, one of the things about energy, and this is what we teach about, is that people understand energy. They understand frequency, and they react to vibration. So when the police came over to us, he automatically knew what he walked up to. I asked him immediately when he said, where's your license and registration? What is your probable cause? He couldn't really tell me what my probable cause was, so he went all around and he started throwing out some letters that I had no idea what he was talking about. I said, that's not probable cause. I haven't committed a crime. What's my crime? What crime have I committed? He said some mumbo jumbo, and I was like ready to ask him how my selfie looked because I was taking one in the process of him talking. Because, like, what are you talking about? And I'm not afraid of you. See, I know who I am. And you feel that I know who I am because you know who I am from just my energy and my vibration. You already know I know who I am. You already know I know I'm God. You already know that. So when he took my license and registration, he came back and he said, I apologize. Yeah, bow down. He said, I apologize. He said, this is something that we just had. He said some old mumble jumble to make him sound right, and you didn't. Because you already knew you had no probable cause of pulling me over, and you already knew that you did not pull over a so-called nigga. Right? So what we have to do as people, and I want you guys to understand, is not all of us don't know our true history. We know that when Christopher Columbus came over here, we were already here, and they stole our history, and they took our books, and they burned them, right? And they took our women, and they raped them, right? And we already had government set up, and they stole our science. We taught them government. We already, see, there's some of us that know that. So we're the group of women that's going to come into the circle, right? And we're going to drop that knowledge that has been hidden, that has been stolen from us for decades. Why? Because we go searching for it. No, it's not a true story. The best way to keep some information from a black man is to put it in a book. It's not a true story because it's millions that's a part of this movement. Look it up. So it's millions that are about to take our nationality back because they stole that too. Oh my God. We're nationalizing now. We understand who we are. We know who we are. And you want to know something? It doesn't even matter if Europeans or so-called white people or whatever want to sit to the side and act like it doesn't affect you, because it will. You want to know why? Because now we're starting to keep our dollar. What we're doing now is we're trying to rotate that so-called black dollar and keep it in our communities. My business is in a block, on a block in Baltimore, where we call that the Black Wall Street. It's 17 black-owned businesses on my block alone. You can come to that block and you can go eat. You can get your makeup done. You can buy your makeup. You can get your hair done. You can get your hair cut. You can buy some clothes and all of that. And you pretty much finish your Saturday without going to the mall supporting any corporations. So you can become a part of the movement, right, and be a good person, because it does affect you. It affects you every single day, and really soon it's going to start affecting that dollar. Black Wall Street is on the rise again. We know who we are, and we're taking our communities back, hands down. No, we're not niggas. We know how powerful our melanin is. We know that we are Aboriginal and Indigenous, and we know that because of police brutality, we know that they know too. That's why they're trying to kill our sons, because they know that our sons are our protectors. They know how powerful the black man is. The black man is a threat to them. What? On every single level, we need to take them out. No, there are no good police officers, not to me. That's why this officer is out of it. Because he understood that he couldn't be a good person and be in something that's systematically built to take the people out. When they get on, yeah, policy enforcers, when they get on their call, they say, we have the number one male in the car. They know the number one male was the number one. They say the number one male because they know that the black man, so-called black man, is Aboriginal to this land. Read between the lines. It's right there in front of you. So once we claim our nationality, man, and once we, I don't believe in voting. Like Devin said, we don't vote. Not no more. Because every single time we put these people in office, they don't do what they say they're going to do. So now we got to take back our vote and take our dollar back at the same time. That's what we're going to do. That's what we're doing. We're going to continue to rise, and we're going to continue to make each and every knowledge deposit that needs to be made until this movement is not just a moment, but it's a movement that's going to shake the entire nation, even you. Thank you.
So now you've seen a whole bunch of different views, different ideas. I want to call everyone up that was a part of this. All the activists, please come up. Tawanda, Shorty, Malika. Where's Michael? Oh, this is my family, y'all. This is the Baltimore family. And I need y'all to ask questions before we get out of here. I want to know, what did you take from this? What do you plan to do? If you plan to take action, were you inspired by this group right here? Were you inspired by my work? Like, I really want to know. I need this feedback, because I plan on taking this show in this group. It's around the world if I can. So I need to, you're my viewers. I'm here to change you. So I need to know, what can I do to impact you? Were you uncomfortable? Let me know. I need to know if my job was complete. Did I do a good job today? Let me know. So I need them questions.
The only thing I'm really confused about is, when you, in your speech you just mentioned right now that you don't vote. Voting is literally the only power that we have. And people... Let me finish, if I may. People vote in general elections, like presidential, senatory, all that stuff, and that's okay. We vote like 70%, which is still nonsense. But when it comes to council elections, the people who decide what gets taught in our schools, the people who decide what our voting margins are, where our houses get built, where loans get made, where is this gun store going to be in my neighborhood or not, those elections, 10%, 12%, these are the ones that actually matter, because they're the ones who legitimately control what goes on in your neighborhood. And so everything we say here, everything that gets talked about, is brilliant and amazing. But the only way change actually gets done is when people actually vote in those, because that's how you control money. That's how you control change. And if you're not going to make those votes, how do you expect change to happen?
So let me go back. I am not voting. I've always voted. This is election season again. So I stood in the long lines. I've even worked the polls, okay, for people that we put in office that I now am fighting against because, you know, they were our best friend when they were running, standing on corners and waving. And now we are fighting against these same people, councilmen that I worked for. My mother stood on the corners and worked for, held up signs for, that have turned their back on a whole entire community in public housing. Okay? These are the same people that I and my family put in office. My influence of my thousands and thousands of people who follow me put in office. And you want to know what they're doing to these people in these communities in public housing? They're saying, screw you. We don't give a shit about you. The same people we put in office. So yes, that is your opinion, and I respect it, but I will not be voting for them anymore this season. I'm taking my vote back.
I'm a black Republican. All right. But I'm a black Republican on this point. I ran for lieutenant governor in the last elections on the ballot. I was the first one to register, and I understand her position on it, nationalization and national, because we property here. We slaves. The only reason I joined the political process to show it was bullshit. And I joined the Republican Party because I don't wear suits and Dockers. You know what I'm saying? I wear hoodies and they ain't good in it. So as far as like you talking about the voting, just this year, Governor Hogan vetoed ex-felons the right to vote in Maryland, and the vote got overturned. Communities United and Baltimore Block and other organizations out for justice got them to overturn the veto. So now ex-felons can vote. So on your aspect and your knowledge and your spin on this factor, imagine if you got 40,000 ex-felons to take over the Republican Party. Imagine if you got 40,000 ex-felons to sit here and vote and put Devin in as this, JC in as that. And we ain't got to run across the Democrats. All we got to do is show up for the party. We ain't got to run for nothing. We ain't got to do nothing. You know what I'm saying? Because we can let them 14, 15 Democrats run for that one seat. All I got to do is be opposition. And you get to meet me at the playground.
Yeah, I want to jump in and say something like, and that's why I love us up here, because we all are unique and different. So I'm the one that I'm going to vote. Like, I'm still in it. I done worked on the sharecropper all day. I get it. But I'm still going to vote for the simple fact I believe in what that brother said. I really do. Because at the end of the day, when we got Greg Bernstein out of office, I'm going to vote.
And I will take you if you need a ride, boo.
Please take me.
And one thing that you said, too, you said the only power that we have is to vote. Nah. No. We prove every day that we got power to go that's way beyond going and signing some ballot or checking some box or something, right? Like, the dude, that CVS burning, that wasn't some, they didn't go there to vote that day. They went to tear that shit up. And there's video out there showing it. When you see the power of people standing up. Now, I'm not saying that we should go out and burn the CVS down the street. Y'all probably got some here too, right? I'm not saying that we should go burn that CVS down. But that's where the power was. When people stand up and they say enough. That's the power. The vote has never been for us, man. Matter of fact, when we first got any kind of or recognition around political power, wasn't even about us. When we were 3/5 of a human being, it was about the Southerners getting us as a part of their voting power. This voting stuff, this political system that we have right now, we got a woman running for president, Clinton, who said that black males are super predators. Super predators. When white males are they wear capes. And they're not called super predators. We're called super predators. So the political power thing, stop telling that lie. Because that's a lie. It's not the truth. We show that we got power with or without the vote. Some of us will be voting, and some of us will not be voting, and we will have power anyway. We can step up and do what we have to do with or without the vote. I'm going to be one of the ones that I'm going to be voting. Okay? I'm going to be voting because I think we need to do that. I think we need to vote. I think we need to have our political voice out there. And I'm going to tell you, I don't think of myself as right and her as wrong because I've been voting my whole life and we still have this same shit that we're living in every day. We still got the same stuff. We got a black president that we put in office. And honestly, he has done very little to make our lives better than they were before he got there. We still have people dying in the streets. And we have had a black president in office for 2 administrations. And we still have black people dying in the streets like they were before. Exactly. So it's not the political, it's not the vote. We can make power known without us going to vote. And that is one arm. That's one arm. But that ain't the only power that I have. Don't take my power away like that.
Let me throw something out that I'd like any of you that like to respond to. I'll start by saying where I'm coming from. I don't think we're going to build a people's movement, black, white, or anything else, inside the Democratic Party or any of the parties. And condolences to Shorty, even in the Republican Party. The Democratic Party is a place where movements go to die, not to be born. So any of the people running, even Bernie Sanders, who I like in many ways, he's a Democrat, and he's going to bring people back to support Hillary if he doesn't get the election. So the vote can be used, I think, tactically. It's not necessarily wrong to vote, and it might be good to vote in certain times to get certain concessions, to get relief, to get something off your back. But to think we're going to change this country in any meaningful way through the electoral process, it's been bought off. The corporations own it. But let me throw out something that extends beyond that, and that has to do with identity politics and systemic change. Reverend Al Sharpton said this past week, I think in response to something Bernie Sanders said, about focusing on breaking up the big banks. He said, well, you can break up the big banks, but black people are still going to be subject to racism. And that's exactly right. But it goes the other way around, too. We can deal with racism, but if we don't deal with capitalism, everybody, black and white, is going to be screwed. So my question is, how do we bring together the power, for example, Tawanda, I mean, your story, what you said, I mean, the power of the personal story of people's real personal involvement in the things that affect their lives. That's where the power lies, in the people's stories and their personal involvement. Bring that together with the need to change the system. Because we can have all sorts of success at the personal level here and there, and it's not going to touch the system. I mean, we see that, for example, just with policing. The police are being militarized. They're being militarized. Why? Because people are starting to stand up, and the people that run things are being prepared to keep that under control and to put it down and to destroy it. We know that. So the frustration I've had through decades of activism is you get people that want to change things on the personal level. You get people that have some grand, vague plans on the bigger level. But I don't see a whole lot coming together where we see how we connect the personal to the change of a system that is destroying not only black people, it's destroying working people of every race, it's destroying people of color in countries throughout the world, and destroying the planet. So what I hope we can take out of this is inspiration from the stories that you specifically are working on, the part of what you are focusing on, because it affects you directly, and all of us, whatever color, need to support that 100%. And we need to move beyond that. And not think that we're going to elect somebody that's going to change it for us. It's going to come from us, black, white, and whatever. So thank you all for offering that inspiration.
I just want to say I love you. We love you, because it's like we over here fighting over you. But you're absolutely correct, because I've been saying it since I've been experiencing this. It's this corrupt system. And until we dismantle that, everything's going to stay the same. It's the same people who are black. It's the complete system that, and it all ties together with the low wages, the mass incarcerations, to police brutality. All that is under that one umbrella until we dismantle it. But right here is power. And with us connecting and giving like our testimonies and going all around the world, connecting with people, and they feeling your personal pain, that's what's going to change things and getting people aboard. Thank you.
And not only that, we have to, our people have to stop selling out. Yes. That's one of the biggest problems. Oh, because make no mistake about it, I can call some names out right now that I feel like are agents, sellouts, and have infiltrated the movement to make the people think they're on our side, and really and truly they're not. So, I mean, myself and Devin even have been approached on so many levels to be a part of certain organizations. Okay? Because when you have a lot of power and when you have people following you, they want to put you on their payroll. And when they put you on their payroll, then they can muzzle you.
Right.
So I had to turn down a lot of positions.
Exactly.
Councilwoman was one of them.
Outcome.
Okay? Because you're not going to muzzle me. You're not going to slide me a note and tell me that's what I'm going to read.
Right.
So we have to stop selling out. Like, our people sell out for a dollar. Like, oh, she's powerful. She need to be a part of us. And then once we become a part of us, it's like, oh, we're going to march and we're going to come together, but really and truly, really working for the man.
Exactly. I work for my people.
And that's where the break keep coming in at.
Exactly.
It continues to be a break because, like the brother said, he said, seem like we be getting somewhere and then it stops. Why stops? Because powerful people like us on the stage sell out. Early. COINTELPRO.
Thank you. One thing, too, about the racism and the capitalism piece, those terms are almost synonymous, capitalism and racism. One doesn't live without the other one. If they're not synonymous, they're certainly sister and brother. They go together. And until we really, I think, the capitalism, dismantle it and dismantle racism at the same time, kill that brother and that sister, we're going to continue to deal with what we have to deal with right now. I do these workshops called Circles of Voices, and in the Circles of Voices, I have people at some point look around the room and find someone who is somewhat unlike you, and you don't know them. So I want to have you all do that for a second. Find someone who's somewhat unlike you. Just look around the room. Find someone who's somewhat unlike you. Yeah, somewhat unlike you, and you don't know them, and look at them for a second. You don't know them, and they're somewhat unlike you. 30 seconds. Everybody got somebody? You got somebody? So until we close that gap, we're going to continue to have the same problems that we've had up to this point. Until I move from where I am over to where somebody else is and start to have real conversations with them and start to engage and start to do the real work about moving through racism and the impact that this fucked up capitalistic system has on people, we're going to continue to go through everything that we've been going up to this point.
My name is Alex. I just moved here from North Jersey, and I'm a student at the University of the Arts, and I'm a painter. And I just want to say that ever since I've gotten here, I've been looking for inspiration everywhere, and I have not received it. And tonight, I've gotten it, like, and then some. Like, I have so many ideas, and I wish I brought my book with me because I have so many ideas. And you guys, like, I don't cry, and I literally sat here and cried. Like, this just made me want to just go and just, like, scream on a rooftop and just paint. And... yeah, and I live in North Jersey. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Newark, but I've watched my uncle get arrested several times when I was younger, and it was hard. And he's been in and out of jail, and it's always been something. And I've watched people that I've known been killed. I've had a friend this summer that was killed and left on a lawn, and no one said anything, and it was never posted anywhere. And we had to find out like days later, and it was hard. And I just want to say that you guys just inspired me and just gave me so much life right now. And I feel like crying again.
Like Devin and him said earlier, part of the movement is part of art. Art is a way of getting a message out, a message in a bottle or a picture. His is the camera lens. Back in the 60s, it was Harry Belafonte, Sidney Poitier did it through movies with Raising in the Sun. You know, we have to use our craft and our gifts. I'm an independent filmmaker as well as an activist. I'm also member of the Creative Alliance, where we do art shows similar to this, where from June till July, for 30 straight days, each one of the members get to show an art exhibit. And my art is toilets, because you treat the underclass like shit. It goes, Jesus had a cross, Martin had a dream, Malcolm got a gun, Shorty got a toilet, but we all had a shit to deal with.
We got any more questions out there?
Hi, I'm Maya, and we go to the same school. I was actually going to kind of say something similar, but addressed to you, Devin, because I'm a photographer, too. And I guess in growing up in art school, if you're not at HBCU, it's kind of like oversaturated with things that don't look like you, and that can be kind of discouraging. So my friend and Samara right there, we came here to your exhibit the other day. And it was, yesterday, and it was just overwhelming. I had to kind of walk out because it's like in the art world you don't see people who look like you. You don't see people like you. You learn about Picasso, you learn about, you know, Da Vinci, Van Gogh, but I'm going to be learning about you one day. And I think that that's like, I can't tell you as a photographer and a filmmaker what you're doing, what that means to me. I like, there are no words, but I kind of wanted to, I guess, hear. You always go to museums and galleries and stuff, but you never really can hear from the artist. So since you're here, can you just kind of like speak on presentation, the process, your process? Like, I think she asked us about, like, did we mind that, you know, your presentation or the fact that you didn't have frames or, you know, can you just speak on that? I need to hear it. I need it.
You might have made me cry, and I don't cry. But I didn't go to art school. I only been a photographer for 3 years. I know, she remember when I first started, I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
Dude,
I shot her daughter, one of my first photo shoots, I shot her daughter in my basement up against the wall. I moved the couch, moved the tea table, and I photographed her daughter. And as an artist, like, people want to give, like, say what an artist is. What is a successful artist? What is an artist? You know, my art is to make you feel. That's what I'm good at. I'm good at creating dialogue. I'm not a journalist. They call me a journalist. Journalists will hate me. But what I found in is when I create, even before this, I can only take good pictures of things that touch my heart. Like, if it didn't touch me, I can't take it. The picture might still be good, but I'd be like, that picture is terrible because I didn't love what I was taking a picture of. So I had to find my own style. So I studied other photographers from, you know, different styles like Gordon Parks all the way to Keith Richards to Tony Barboza to Robert Houston to all these. I just studied. You know, I just read. I didn't know anything. All I had was YouTube and my camera, you know, and I learned the hard way. Even now, I'm still learning. You know, I fuck pictures up all the time. I'm like, damn, I should have did this or I should have did that. But putting together a presentation, even this one, this is my first real show. Unfiltered. I had hands on deck. Had my friends help. All right, we put this show together in one day. This is one day of work, you know. And we just got the picture. You say, all right, so what you want to do? We changed the idea about 15 million times, and I let my heart guide me to get it done. I don't do frames because this is not fine arts. This is not here to be like, oh, this is pretty. This is here to get the point across. A beautiful ghetto. A beautiful ghetto. That's the name of this show. And the goal of the show is to put you in Baltimore, make you feel the uprising, and inspire you. You know, like if I put them in pretty frames, you wouldn't be inspired. You'd be like, oh, this image is beautiful. The black and white is so gorgeous. I don't want you to feel that. I want you to cry. I want you to feel enraged. I want you to leave here wanting to make change. Mm-hmm. I'm a good storyteller, so I told you a story. Mm-hmm. But when you come in here, you forget that story. You connect to every image, and that's the goal. If I can't make you feel, there's no point. You know, so my goal and my life goal is to make everyone feel around the world. You know, so knowing that you are inspired, you almost cried, my job is done.
I just want to say to you also, I want you to just show up. Like, being on the outside, like, Devin is my little brother, but sometimes, you know, we can't really tell the story like another person standing back watching can tell the story. Devin just showed up to the move. Devin just was a photographer, baby, just like you. Okay, he was learning, he is learning, just learning his craft, just enjoying what he does, and he just showed up and boom, captured that right picture that went viral. So you continue to take your pictures. You go all around and you take images of things that you feel like your spirit led you to take. You see images that don't look like you. You bring more of you to what you feel like you need to do for your craft and be spirit led. The reason why, so what? They don't have frames, right? We break law. That's what we do. Like, we're free. Like, a lot of people say, well, Malika, you know, you're an activist and you wear makeup. I love it. I have my own cosmetic line of makeup and I'm going to wear it. I don't have to be this natural sister all the time. You know, just be free and you let your spirit lead you. And you're going to do well. I feel it.
Hi, I'm DeAndra, and I came here with Maya, Alex, and I go to Temple, and it's really difficult being in a predominantly white setting, especially when I come from the South Bronx. So many of the areas that you, it's like walk. Sometimes it's like walking. Like looking at these pictures feels like walking down like some areas in the Bronx. It feels like walking. Shit, feels like walking like on campus to. Like on North Philly, and it makes me feel like less alone, because it makes me feel like they're people that have succeeded and can tell these stories, and I'm sorry, like,
take your time,
and can accurately understand what it's like to be in these areas and have the need to succeed for the people like Freddie Gray, like Eric Gardner.
You're never alone, you know, and I'm going to just keep it real. You know, like, I don't hide anything about my past. If you read any of my interviews, I'm pretty straightforward about where I come from. And even now, people think, like, I made it. I go through the same situations as you. Instagram sent me to photojournalism, you know, event in Virginia. I was the only black. Out of like 1,000+ photographers, I was the only African American brother. I'm saying there was other brothers there from Ghana, you know, different places of the world. But being an African American brother from the hood, I was the only one, and I felt alone. I sat there. I went to Fuji, the camera that I use, and I said, you know, I have these amazing ideas. You know, I use your camera. I'm your biggest shooter right now. Tom said I'm the best photographer in Maryland. I'm this and that. I'm the third amateur photographer. I'm just going. Running down, you know, this was in June of last year. I'm telling them all I've done. You know, I made Time Magazine. I'm the third amateur photographer to do that. I'm the black photographer to get the cover of Time with a full spread and return to do that. They didn't give a fuck. They told me my work was negative. Wow. They wouldn't sponsor. They said, oh, we don't do sponsorships. They told me that, the rep told me that to my face. Oh, yeah, we saw, but we didn't want to promote that with our brand because it's negative. And I questioned, like, my past, like, do I still want to be a photographer at that point? And mind you, at that festival, I did the video that's back here, you can go view it. This is a presentation that Instagram that I recorded at National Geographic for this festival. And that hurt. You know, and I talked to other, you know, some white photographers, and I told him what happened. I never forget what he said. He said, hey, one of the guys, he's super cool. He said, yo, you forget that you're black? I'm like, what you mean? I'm like, you're black. He was like, all right, I'm going to send you some stuff. So I see all these other Fuji shooters that all have like their little Fuji groups, you know, a group of photographers, they in Africa documenting the trials and tribulations of Africa and these other places. They get free cameras from Fuji. I couldn't even get a free camera. So I said, what should I do? You know, he said, stop. Mind you, I love this camera. That's why I took all these amazing images with. He said, you can't use the camera no more. He was like, you're an activist, right? If you're really down, put the camera down. So I had to put it down. I said, what should I do? Joe from City Paper said, he's like, what's your most powerful tool other than that camera? I was like, what you mean? He was like, boy, you're a social media sensation. Tweet it. I tweeted it. Next thing I know, they emailed me, hey, Devin, can we send you a camera? No. After I already emailed him 2 and 3 times, you know, I did never reply. I put the camera down. I had to, you know, take my hard-earned money, you know, and people think I make a lot of money. I don't. And I had to basically break my back and buy, you know, a whole nother system. And that, and you know, as a photographer, changing a whole system is not easy.
GoFundMe account?
I had to go start a GoFundMe account to get my cameras to teach my youth program. They didn't want to sponsor that when I pitched it to them. You know, so let me just let you know this. Just because I'm here doesn't mean anything. I'm here because I'm fighting for people like you and me, black artists that do not get the same support and the same luxuries. I reached out to Leica camera company too, my dream camera, you know, and the rep, mind you, these cameras are $5,000, $6,000. Oh, no, we don't give out free cameras, but we give you a $500 discount on a $7,000 camera with no lens. But then when I go to Instagram, I see white photographers, thank you, Leica, for sending me this camera. Mind you, I have a bigger Instagram following. My voice is larger. I have more things under my belt. I've been published multiple times, Time Cover of the Year. Voted on a list with Donald Trump, Kim Kardashian, and all these other clowns. It's Person of the Year. Magnificent Seven on Vibe Magazine with Serena Williams. BET Black History Month. Vibe, what else? Revolt TV came here. I can drop names all day, but at the end of the day, I'm black. I don't get this. We don't get that support, period. So, you know, when you feel uncomfortable, think about that and let that inspire you to push harder, because this is a struggle. All these things that I name, it don't mean nothing. If I told you how much money was in my bank account, you'd be like, are you serious? You know, I turn down jobs. I can't be a photojournalism because I own all my pictures. I make money because I have to sell them for them to go to CNN and these other places. But I have to control that dialogue of that image, and I'm not allowed to do that in photojournalism. So I had to take a full-time job now working with Under Armour and take some time off and work on my book. Under Armour is the only people that even offer me a job. Oh, they'll freelance me. Oh, they'll write stories about me all day. But they will not give me a job, and they will not support me. And that's just what it is. But you got to keep fighting. We got to change the world. You're not alone. We together.
And one thing that's behind the question, too, for us, right? We can't look for black confirmation from white supremacy. If we live like we won't be full and complete until we get that, we're never going to be full and complete. We have to stand, we have to know who we are, like our center, like the sisters have been talking about tonight, like we've been talking about tonight. We have to find our own center that has nothing to do with white supremacy, nothing to do with suppression of black people. And when you find that, you can walk through Philadelphia and all white communities and still know who you are despite what they're doing. You can walk someplace and not get that camera and know that it's about their ignorance and not about you, or something is less about you than it is about those white people who are getting it, who are not as talented as you are. So until we find our own center, until we find out who we are, and not look for our confirmation from people who intend to exact our demise, we won't be full and complete as human beings.
When you are confident, you are going to shift the atmosphere. Europeans, so-called white people, all of them, they know who you are. They study your history. They want you to. And once you do, they will know who you are. When I'm standing beside a European woman or a European man, white man, whatever you want to call them, they know I know who I am. Period. And I'm going to shift the atmosphere every single time I walk past them. You're not better than me. Okay? So you walk with that, and you stand in your authority and know who you are. That's why you wear your hair like you wear your hair. Your melanin baby is powerful. Powerful. So you know that, and don't ever forget it. So when you go home, I want you to pray for more confidence. Period.
We have time for two more questions.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth. I'm a fifth grade teacher. I teach in a Philly charter school. I know it's complicated, but I wasn't sure if I was going to get a chance to talk to you. It was very crowded, so I was like, maybe I'll muster up the courage to raise my hand for the mic. So I was really glad I happened to come upon this space, because I happened to be here for a teacher event. I didn't know this exhibit was going on, and it actually ended up being a really lucky coincidence, because every year for the past 3 years, I've been doing service learning projects with my kids. And this year, one of my classes decided they wanted to focus on police brutality. And it's the first year that they've decided to focus on race. And, you know, every time I open up the discussion, it's just every day it's a learning experience. And I find that it's the most powerful time I spend with my students. And, you know, it's been a blessing, because I went into education thinking I want to open up dialogues about race from an early age. And I was just wondering, I mean, when I found out about you, and, you know, you work with youth, you work with photography, and just like the amazing following that you've built just through your art alone. I really wanted to connect with you guys. I didn't know that you're going to bring such amazing people also. So, and I actually, we've watched Michael Wood, we watched one of your videos in class and discussed it as well, and they've used it in their persuasive writing as well. So it's been a really lucky coincidence, and I just wanted to make sure I made my face known so that we could connect later. It would be amazing if you could, I don't know how long you're in Philly, but if you could work with our students too, I think they would be more than ecstatic about it.
Yeah, I would love to come work with you. I'm only here for the day. I got to head back to Baltimore, but you can get my information from Slot. You know, I don't have a problem coming working with your kids. That's what I love to do. So after this, I'm hanging around for a while so we can talk.
My name is Samara, and I go to school at UArts of Maya. Every Thursday, we have a photo class, and we're the only black girls in the class. So every time we get together, we just talk about, like, I mean, I feel so alone there. I come from D.C., and the day after the Freddie Gray protests, like the riots, I was there the next day. I took a train by myself. I'd never been to Baltimore, and I got shots, and I was on the front lines. And I think I was there when you took that photo of the lady with the stop killer cops. I was next to photographers who were from Vice and Times. And I've been shooting for 6 years. I'm self-taught. And I like to shoot real things, my community, what I see, what I feel. And, like, I don't know. So, like, 2 weeks ago was the first time that I was, like, called a nigger. Like, for art. I created art, and it got, like, a huge response. I'm sorry.
No, keep going.
No, online, but, like, I want to be a photojournalist, but there's no one like me in my field, you know? And the only person I can look up to is Gordon Parks. That's the only college photographer that, like, has inspired me, and then there's you. No, and it's funny because my friends, they know you. My friend Issa, she's from Baltimore, whatever, she goes to school there. She says, I know Devin. And I said, please, I need to, like, meet him. I need to connect because, like, Maya's the only other black girl photographer. There's, like, no one else. It's just whitewashed. And, like, this is what I love to do. But there's no one. And, like, I feel, you know, my school, I get stared at because, like, I wear my hair like this because of my skin, because of the way I dress. And it's, like, I don't know. I'm an activist as well. I run, like, a young women's movement from D.C. I live in Philly now, but I'm running a movement that I'm trying to expand all over the world. And it's just, it's hard. But there's people like you who inspire people like me, and I'm going to change the world, and I know it, and I feel it. So thank you.
You know, that really touched me. You know, we in the same box. You know, like, we in the same box. You're not alone, trust me. There's a lot of us out there. But you was called a nigga because you did something right. Whatever you did touched that person so much and made them feel so uncomfortable, they had to make you feel uncomfortable. Do you know? But because you're doing a good job. That's what happens. Oh, you think I wasn't called a nigga? You should see the comments when I landed Time magazine. What I learned, Tom said, when my work got out there, he said, look, don't read the comments. But I read them anyway. I've been a nigga, a monkey, and everything else under the sun. That's because we're doing something right. We're making change. And you're right, it's not a lot of us in photojournalism. But that's the problem. That's why we got to do what we do. And, you know, and it's not, the thing is, they let you only think that it's Gordon Park. I want you to look for a documentary called Through the Lens Darkly. It talks about the power of an image. Did you know Frederick Douglass was a photographer? Half the pictures you see of him was self-portraits. They wouldn't tell you that. He's one of the most photographed men in the 19th century, if not the most photographed person, because he understood the power of image. He did self-portraits from the beginning to the end, till he died. W.E. Du Bois, another one, photographer, ran a magazine. They don't tell you these things. Robert Houston, famous for photographing what really got Martin Luther King killed, that Poor People campaign in D.C. You won't know about that. That's what got him killed. He started messing with the white man money. Like, oh, no, we got to go. But you won't hear about Robert Houston, who's also from East Baltimore, whose mentor was Gorton Parks. And who his mentee is now? Me. They're not going to tell you. You got to dig. It's a lot of amazing black photographers out there, but we were shut out early. Gorton Parks, they give us Gorton Parks, but they're going to shut the other stuff down. But trust me, we're going to connect. We're not alone. Keep doing what you're doing. You know, you got the support of my team. We're family. Everyone in this room that's listening, we're family. And when you walk and you get them looks because of how you dress, flip your head. I get looks too. When I come and talk, they see this. They see my braids. They see my bush. They feel uncomfortable. Do I care? No. That's why I say when I get my job under arm, I'm going to get a mouthful of goals and I'm going to come to work every day and make them white people feel uncomfortable. You know, it's about change. People have to accept you for who you are and they don't. Fuck it. Fuck it.
You don't wear your hair like this. You wear your hair. That's what you wear. The stash should be when the hair's all the way down here. You wear your hair. You say, it's nobody like me. Be the first. Be the first. I'm the owner of my own cosmetic line of makeup, skincare, author, motivational speaker, and guess what? I don't care who didn't do it first. Be the first. And I have people every single day that say they need me. And I'm going to tell you, I need you. I need you to understand what your path is, to understand why you came here, to fulfill your assignment. Don't get offended when nobody call you a nigga. I wish somebody would call me a nigga. I know where the word nigga come from. I know where the whole monkey thing come from. It wasn't us. Look up the word troglodyte nigga chimpanzee. All right? Europeans was called the niggas first. We niggered them first and then they niggered us back. I'm going to give you the real truth, baby. So don't you ever get offended at that word nigga. And when you're not offended of that word nigga, they will shrivel. Mark my words. Know who you are, boo. You God.
You got time for one more question. No more questions? All right. Oh, yeah, sure. I'm gonna let you go.
You said follow our inspiration, follow what we can do that nobody else can do, and y'all have a way with words. A lot of us are university students, and universities have a lot of money, they have a lot of resources. I want to know, like, what we can do, like, what the movement needs from university students, because I know I can, like, follow my path and what I think is right, but I want to make sure that what I think is right is actually right. So tell me, like, what you think the movement needs from university students now.
We need a lot. How about... I want you to talk to each one of them afterwards, because that's a question that you need to figure out how you can help each one of them. They all have different, you know, thoughts. So connect with them. Right, I'm talking about like right after we done, go right and talk to them.
So essentially, on that campus, just like all campuses in America, you know that people are being subjugated on those campuses. Do something. There to like make it so that, you know, students coming through those schools don't have to go through what they're going through. My daughter's right now at UCLA. She's graduating this year. 2% black student population on a campus in the middle of LA. In the middle of LA. She's a photographer, man. And she's done well. And she's with the UCLA Daily Bruin. And she's a writer. And she's a photographer. She does both on her stories. And sometimes she gets these stories, she writes them, and then they'll put her story in the middle of the paper and put some other thing on the front because somebody white did it for real. Let's tell it like it is. And then the public will make her story more popular than the one that's on the front page because, you know, we love to put our stuff, or the systems love to put our stuff in the middle and put the white people up front. So at your school, they're doing that. I don't even know what school you're talking about, and they're doing that. Do something about it. Step up and get active and bring us in so they can see our faces and our braids, you know, and hear us talk to them so they can understand what the impact that it's having.
First, thank all of you for a real inspirational evening. It was It was very heartfelt and wonderful to be here. I'd like to say one thing, especially to young people that have spoken up today. The people that control the society do so in large measure because they divide us. First, in this society, first of all, by race, but also by sex, by gender, by orientation, you know, all different kinds of things to make us think that we are different and can't work together. Now, I happen to be a white guy, so I can slip under the radar with these people a lot. I can get away with some things that maybe some other people can't so easily. And believe me, I'm doing it. So, I mean, if they knew what I'm doing, what I think, they'd call me a lot worse than nigger. But know that, you know, when you're walking down the street, that it may be a guy like me, an older white guy with a beard, that may be a real ally to you. Don't assume, don't put me into a category or anybody into a category that's given by the people that run this society. You know, there are many of us of all different races, ages, gender orientation, whatever, that are allies with each other. And we're going to work together to build a society. I've been working since I've been the age of a lot of students here. And I can give you a list as long as my arm of disappointments that I have of things that didn't happen. But I can also tell you a lot of wonderful things that happened and things that we have possible today. I'm a historian, and I'll tell you this one last thing. We live in a historic juncture. When the old system is falling apart and new possibilities are going to arise, and I think our job is to begin to nurture those seeds and those sprouts of the new society. No mistake about it, as that system falls apart, it is going to be violent. It is going to reach out to destroy anything that challenges it. Don't be naive to think that's going to happen or you have some, pure ideology. No. If you do anything worthwhile, you're going to get called worse than nigger, believe me. So understand that it happens through places like this. People coming together, people understanding we have something. I mean, how stupid is it? How stupid is it for people to divide each other based on the color of our skin? How utterly ridiculous is that? And yet so many people buy that. 20% of Trump voters think slavery, should have kept going. Okay, we've got a lot of Neanderthals in this society, a lot of them. But we've also got a lot of really good, decent people. And every time one of us speaks up, that emboldens and encourages somebody else to speak up. I've seen that happen. I've gone from being, a younger person who's afraid of this or worried about that or what are people going to think, to somebody that learns to speak up. So if each of us do that in our own way, through our art, through our activism, through whatever our way is, you will embolden other people, and you will never know. I know as a teacher, you never know how people are going to be affected, sometimes till much later or never at all. But don't be afraid to be yourself and to speak up and to speak for, as people said here with their art, for what you can believe in and you know is important. Because things are happening. They are.
I want to thank every last one of y'all for coming out. It means so much to me. I know it was a very uncomfortable change in time. So we're going to end this night on a good note with some positive vibes. I want y'all to get together, hug each other, conversate, talk to these people. Come close. We are a family. I want this to feel like a family reunion right now. I want everyone to come in close and let's celebrate, because a couple years ago, things like this was not happening. Things are really changing. And it starts with you just by coming here and just listening to ordinary people. So I want y'all to listen to some good vibrations, good energy from Al Rogers. He has an amazing song called Honey. It's about everything ain't honey. Everything ain't what it seems in the streets. So come vibe with us. And I want you to talk to everyone that was on this panel and get that information. Let's go.